Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals, our 3 o'clock session. This is the fourth today, so you're the finale, the grand finale. Your panel this afternoon is, to my right, Justice Sue Walker, to my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofino. All right, both sides ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
The court calls William Waters versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Brian Weiss will represent the appellant and Ms. Lori Casco will represent the state.
Okay, Brian, you gave us this. Lori, you gave us this. Did both sides get a copy of the other sides?
Yes, Your Honor. And may it please this honorable court, I am Brian Weiss from Houston on behalf of the appellant, William Barry Waters III, and it is, again, a privilege to appear again before this tribunal. This case requires this court to determine whether or not the trial prosecutor's express invitation to the jury in the final moments of his opening argument to consider the application of the parole law as it impacted this appellant, error that the state by its silence in this court essentially concedes, compels a reversal of the 60-year sentence, the functional equivalent of a life sentence for purposes of parole. And there are 3 reasons why this court's task in sustaining point one is not onerous. First, the state by its silence in this court concedes the trial prosecutor's comment was error. Secondly, the state's preservation gambit ignores the context exception of TRAP 33.1. And finally, all 3 of the Mosley factors that inform this court's harm analysis clearly fall on appellant's side of the ledger. The argument that's at issue that this court has by now reviewed reflects that no less than 6 times the trial prosecutor used the word he or him in referring to the appellant before he finally tells the jury. So if he has good time credit, that gives him extra credit. He might, it'd be less than 15 years. Okay, you understand that. All right, so the reality of the situation is if you give him 60 years or more, you're doing all that you can. And at that point, trial counsel objects, and I think that the objection is more than ample to preserve this claim, given the context, quote, that, no doubt referring to the argument hard on the heels that he had just heard, that violates the charge of the court, that's not to be considered by the jury, and I object to counsel arguing that. And the veteran trial judge responded with but one word, overruled. The context exception to TRAP 33.1 says that even though an otherwise imprecise objection is leveled, if it's apparent from the context, and clearly the context of this exchange makes manifest the fact that the objection itself was directed at the improper invitation for jurors to apply the parole law. And it's ironic that in the state supplemental list of authorities, which I was handed 5 minutes ago, that one of the cases they rely on is Judge Benavides' opinion in Langston, because Langston is our strongest case, frankly, because Judge Benavides, at the time a Court of Criminal Appeals judge, now 5th Circuit judge, made it clear that no special script is required to preserve error, and that error preservation is not to be accomplished by splitting hairs in the appellate court. While the state claims that trial counsel's objection, that is not in the jury charge, could have been directed to any of the other half dozen preclusions or prohibitions, again, the context exception, which the state does not discuss in its brief, makes manifest the fact that this claim is preserved for review. The state's second part of its tripartite error preservation gambit is that somehow the claim on appeal does not track the trial complaint. And I would submit that the authorities that we have pointed out to this court in our supplemental brief, again, underscore the tenet that we don't look at appellate briefs with the fervor that a 5th grade grammar teacher does. Why? Because TRAP and the case law that interprets it makes it clear that we are to construe briefs liberally with an eye towards doing justice, and so long as a claim is fairly encompassed by the trial objection, then that matters properly before this court. And given the notion that this trial objection is specific enough, the trial objection and the appellate contention are close enough, as it were, to preserve error. The third peg to the state's tripartite error preservation argument is that trial counsel also alluded to the parole law in his argument. Well, in a word, it's irrelevant. Why? Because as this court held in LaJoy, a case that I had the privilege of arguing 2 years ago with Justice Walker on the panel, this court made it clear, in tracking case law from the Court of Criminal Appeals, that defense counsel is entitled to speak to evidence that was improperly introduced, or as in this case, argument that was improperly made, to explain, rebut, destroy, or ameliorate the harm that's attendant upon that initial evidence or argument. So at the end of the day, that notion is itself a non-starter. Given the fact that the state, by its silence in this court, concedes that the trial prosecutor's comment was error, and we have favored the panel with a rough flowchart that compares the argument made in this case with the argument in Perez, which again certainly underscores the notion that the argument in this case was egregious. The only remaining issue for this court, I submit, is whether or not this forensic misconduct is sufficient to compel the reversal of the 60-year punishment verdict. But at the outset, Your Honors, there are three important fundamental notions that inform this court's 44.2b analysis that you won't find in the state's brief. Number one, if this court is unsure of whether or not this error affected the outcome, as Justice Walker pointed out for this court in Russell, it must treat the error as if it did. Secondly, as Judge Cochran pointed out for the Court of Criminal Appeals in Burnett, in cases of grave doubt as to the harmlessness of an error, the appellant wins. In a more colloquial sense, the tie, as it were, goes to the runner, in this case, the appellant. And finally, this court's 44.2b analysis is not a sufficiency of the evidence analysis under Jackson, because the issue is the effect of the error and not whether or not the untainted evidence in this case is overwhelming. So, viewed through this prism, each of the three Mosley factors fall on this appellant's side of the ledger. Number one, the severity of the misconduct, which, as the Court of Criminal Appeals has noted in Hawkins, really speaks to the prejudice attendant upon the argument. I submit that the state's failure to even challenge the propriety of this argument is itself the most compelling evidence of the prejudice. Number two, the argument at issue is not some arcane prohibition. It's not the rule in Shelley's case. This is argument that has been improper since LBJ was president. This is argument that goes back decades and decades. And as Chief Justice Quinn pointed out for the Amarillo court, that goes to the notion of whether this court, declaring this error harmless, would encourage the state to repeat it with impunity in future cases. Moreover, the timing of the misconduct is important, because in cases as in Chester and York, appellate courts have made it clear that because this comes at the tail end of the trial process, it is not easily forgotten. Cases, by the way, Chester and York, among a dozen or so that the state opts neither to discuss or to distinguish in its brief. Number two, steps taken to cure the misconduct. I submit that the only way the state makes the argument that this somehow falls on its side of the ledger is to rewrite this record in case law. Why? Because this veteran trial judge overruled this objection. And as this court knows in cases such as Chester and Person, that puts the seal of judicial approval on the error. And while the state claims that both the trial judge and the trial prosecutor took steps to cure the misconduct, I submit that rejoinder will not support the weight resting on it. Why? Because unlike Hawkins, which we'll talk about in detail in a moment, there was no apology or clarification from the prosecutor. It was merely argument that directed the jury back to the proper portion of the trial court's charge. And while the trial court did in fact instruct the jury properly as to the parole law charge, I submit that curative action is curative action when taken at the time of the misconduct and not when the trial court's charge is prepared. I submit that this factor as well falls on appellant's side of the ledger. And finally, Your Honors, the certainty of the sentence assessed absent the misconduct on the continuum of 25 years to life, clearly a 60-year sentence, the functional equivalent of a life sentence or a 99-year sentence for purposes of parole, is itself compelling evidence that this factor falls on appellant's side of the ledger. Moreover, as in Chester, Chief Justice Quinn pointed out that the presence of a jury note asking the difference between, and it doesn't make any difference what the jury wants to know, life in 99, 60 in life. At the end of the day, as Justice Dauphinon pointed out in her concurring opinion in Taylor, there's only one reason why juries send out that note. It's because they're attempting to apply the parole law to that individual defendant. And while the state claims that there's no indication in its amended brief that that note somehow impacts this court's harm determination, I submit that that claim is foreclosed by both Justice Dauphinon's concurring opinion in Taylor and by Chief Justice Quinn's opinion in Perez. It's not a coincidence, Your Honors, that the trial prosecutor asked this jury to give the appellant 60 years. Within 45 minutes from the time the jury goes out, there's a note sent, again asking what's the difference between life and 99. Several minutes later, the jury comes back and answers the prosecutor's invitation. I submit that is not a coincidence in the grand scheme of things. But while the state attempts to find safe harbor on the strength of a number of submissions vis-a-vis the harm analysis, I submit that all of them lack merit. Perhaps the least impressive is its claim that because the appellant didn't file a motion for new trial alleging jury misconduct, that somehow there's a presumption that this fact-finding body didn't consider the parole law. Well, with all due respect, Your Honors, I think it comes within a coat of paint of being disingenuous to claim that an appellant hasn't filed a motion that depends upon evidence that this court and every other appellate court in Texas has held is itself inadmissible under Rule 606B. Another non-starter, the state's claim that by my use of the word draconian and a footnote to describe the 60-year sentence meted out in this case, that somehow that creates an additional appellate claim, one neither alleged nor briefed and certainly not argued today, that this sentence is cruel and unusual punishment. I submit that is a claim that has no impact at all on this court's harm determination. And while the state essentially, vis-a-vis harm, again, Your Honors, puts virtually all of its eggs in the basket of Hawkins versus State from the Court of Criminal Appeals, an opinion by Presiding Judge Keller, I submit that Hawkins is distinguishable on multiple levels. First of all, and foremost, the argument in Hawkins was not improper, unlike the argument in this case, which the state by its silence concedes. Secondly, the claim in Hawkins was procedurally defaulted because there was no objection that the argument directed the jury to consider the application of the parole law. The court sustained the objection in Hawkins and instructed jurors to disregard. But moreover, Mr. Hawkins, God bless him, was a one-man crime wave. And as I understand his prior criminal history, he had at least seven priors, including four involving the possession or sale of dangerous drugs, several with the element of violence, including robbery by assault and aggravated robbery, and the primary offense was possession of a controlled substance, but in the process, possessing a firearm with hollow point, dum-dum bullets. Here, by contrast, in this case, the state concedes the argument is improper, the claim is preserved, there is no meaningful curative action. The defendant's priors, none of which involve violence. Don't you know that if they had, the state would have brought that out not only in the trial court, but before this tribunal today? All of the appellant's priors were alcohol-related. At the end of the day, this case presents in compelling terms manifestly improper argument made by a trial prosecutor whose zeal for the sale of a 60-year sentence caused him to lose sight of the warranty that is this appellant's right to a tolerably fair punishment hearing. I ask this court to sustain point one and remand this case for a new punishment hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. May it please the court. I guess I'd first like to respond to some of appellant's comments. He first characterizes the one statement that's at issue in this case. His issue number one is that this occurred at the tail end of the prosecutor's argument, and that's not true. It occurred at the end of the first section of the prosecutor's argument, and then the prosecutor went on to say four similar things
in the second half of his argument in rebuttal, and with no objection whatsoever. And so I just wanted to make the court aware that there was a great deal of argument after that particular comment occurred. He also...
Am I mistaken, or didn't the trial court grant a running objection?
Your Honor, the trial court granted a running objection to the arguments that it was outside the record. Although I believe Mr. Weiss is not arguing that, that's his point two. There were four arguments outside the record in point two. And I believe he's conceded that the cases that I cited in support of point two basically nullified that point. So we're only arguing really on point one.
I don't seem to believe that each other are conceding a lot. He thinks you concede that this was error, and now you think he concedes that your cases make his, that he's not pursuing those points because of your cases. I'm not sure either one of y'all concede any of those things. Do you concede that this argument in point one was in fact error?
No, ma'am, I do not. I think the case law is very mixed on this point, but our primary argument on this, as Mr. Weiss so clearly points out, is argument preservation. He argues in his supplemental pretrial submission brief that because the state is arguing error preservation, that somehow our case is so weak that's all we have left to argue. But error preservation is the foundation, it's the bedrock of appellate complaints. And the cases that I cited in my my paper that I submitted to you today with just a few additional cases, including the case that Mr. Weiss cites, the Langston case, very strongly support the fact that 33.1 is a judge-protecting rule. It's a raise-it-or-waive-it rule. And yes, although there are some contextual exceptions, it needs to be clear to this court from the record exactly what the objection was. 33.1 promotes judicial economy. If we allowed every general objection made at the trial court level to be overturned on appeal or even considered on appeal, then we are doing nothing more than promoting sloppy lawyering.
Violates the charge of the court that's not to be considered by the jury.
Well, Justice Dofano, I don't know what was in the judge's mind, and that's part of the problem of having an imprecise objection. The court did not make any kind of suggestion afterwards, as in Everett. The trial judge immediately understood. There was a general objection in Everett. The trial judge understood what the objection was and said, and sort of admonished the prosecutor at that point and said, you know, just talk about such and such, don't talk about that. That was a clear understanding from a cold record that showed that judge had an understanding of what the objection was about. We don't have that here.
You are conceding it was an improper argument. Is that what you're saying, that the trial judge, if he'd understood the objection, would have admonished the prosecutor? Is that what you're saying?
It's possible. I don't have any idea whether he would have or not. I'm arguing that the imprecise objection that the appellant gave at the trial court was not enough to put everybody on notice. It would have been very simple to say he's arguing the parole law. That's very simple to say.
In the Chester case that was cited by the appellant here, the defense counsel's objection was simply that's improper argument.
Right.
There can't be more of a general objection than that's improper argument.
That's
and
true.
Yet that case was reversed, and the Court of Criminal Appeals refused discretionary review, and that was the argument in that case was found to be error.
Well, there are other arguments, Justice Gabriel, that from other cases that have been just as close to the line or similar to that in other cases, and sometimes courts reverse on those. Sometimes they don't. It's difficult for trial attorneys to be able to tell where the line is when it's not clearly drawn.
That was a general objection.
I understand.
More general than this one.
I understand. Continuing on, though, if you'll allow me to, it's also well settled that if a defendant does not object to similar arguments, and as I stated before, this argument came at the end of the first part of the state's case. There were four other arguments in the second part that received no objection whatsoever.
For the parole arguments?
Four other arguments that were similar in the second part of the state's statement, argument that received no objections from defense counsel.
Where are the other parole arguments?
On my brief on page 15, but they appear on page 51. Of the record. No objections whatsoever to that. And as Justice Walker pointed out, there were four objections to arguing outside the record, and in fact, trial counsel asked for a running objection to those. And that's the purpose of 33.1, to preserve error like that. When you have an objection and then you have other similar arguments that are not objected to, then you have to wonder how serious that objection was to start with, or even if the objection related to the parole law the first time, because the defendant did not preserve his error by continuing to object. This was not a rookie trial lawyer trying this case. This is a seasoned veteran attorney who basically knows the difference between making a coherent objection that will preserve error and those that won't. And the state maintains that he did not fulfill his duty in putting the trial court and the prosecutor and everyone on notice that he was what a basis he was objecting under. So we would argue that that they forfeited their right because they did not object to those similar arguments. In response to some other things that Mr. Weiss said, he said that there is grave doubt, that if there is grave doubt that this appellant, that this one argument made a difference in this appellant's sentence, then this court should rule in favor of the appellant. I would submit that there's no doubt that this had any effect whatsoever. And I know that appellant doesn't want to argue cruel and unusual punishment, although that seems to be what he's suggesting when he says that 60 years is draconian for a habitual DWI offender like Mr. Waters. But things are a little bit different in Hood County than they are in Harris County. And Hood County jurors do not tolerate people who are repeat DWI offenders who are actually on parole for your second felony DWI for which you went to prison, and you're out drinking and driving again. They have no sympathy for that. There are 10 defendants right now that are in TDC that have 50-year or greater sentences for DWIs out of our county.
You're arguing things that we don't know, that aren't in the record, that we can't consider in making this decision. I mean, you're...
I understand that, Your Honor. I understand that. And I'm not saying for you to take that as the verbatim truth. I'm just saying that in the context of what a jury expects and what the jury is the finder of how long of a sentence that is appropriate for a particular defendant. And in this case, 60 years is smack dab in the middle between 25 and 99. And for somebody with this record...
Explain to them that 60 was the same as 99 versus a parole. So that really is an awful lot of weight.
I understand.
Didn't affect the jury. I mean, how can you really say that there was no harm?
I guess I can just say, based on my experience, that sentence is not outside the realm of what this defendant would get. And I can say that, you know, if this court decides that there was error, and if this court decides that it was harmful to this defendant, then, you know, we will go back for another punishment trial. And, you know, it's not going to affect the guilt innocence. It will affect the punishment, and we will go back and do it again, and most likely we'll get the same result. That's just from my personal experience, and I realize that that's not really before the court. Mr. Weiss argues that this court should construe briefs liberally, according to whatever case he was citing, but we're not talking about construing briefs liberally here. We're talking about construing trial objections. There's no error in how Mr. Weiss is arguing his point. So I believe that recommendation is misplaced in this objection, in this hearing, in this argument. You know, Judge Campbell said in a dissent in Young v. State, he said, there's something unseemly about telling a trial court it erred when it was never presented with the opportunity to be right. And I think we have to consider when someone makes an imprecise trial objection, if we reward that by going to the merits of that objection with an imprecise objection, we're encouraging more imprecise trial objections and sloppy lawyering. There's just really no excuse for not saying what it is that you want. And you don't have to use magic words, but you do need to make it clear to everybody involved, to make it clear to the trial court judge, make it clear to the opposite side, so that those mistakes can be cured. And they can be cured at the trial court, where it's the most important place to take care of them. If that argument was so egregious and so bad, why didn't he object to the other four times that there were similar arguments given? The statement that you make, Justice Gabriel, that was the last thing he asked for before they broke, that was five objections, you know, possible objections down the line from the very first one. If a proper objection had been made at the time and the court could have said, this is wrong, then those other objections probably wouldn't, those other statements wouldn't have been made, and we wouldn't have gotten to this point. That's the importance of error preservation. Under 33.1, you need to make everybody aware of what's going on and make sure everybody's on the same page, and so that we can fix the problem before we end up at this point arguing about something that happened 6 months ago and that could have been fixed at the trial court level very easily. Could have been fixed if it was error, could have been fixed with a sustain and instruction to disregard, and then we would have been on our way. And that, I guess that's basically my point. I just don't want this court to short-circuit the error preservation argument, because that's so important. It's so important in what we do every day in the trial court. And I appreciate your consideration of this. I know it's difficult. And we urge you to sustain the verdict of the jury and the sentence of this defendant. Thank you.
And may it please this honorable court. In the 30 years I've been appearing before appellate courts in Texas, I take my responsibility to hew to the facts and the record seriously. I invite this court to go back and listen to the tape of my opening remarks, where I said, in fact, that the trial prosecutor's comments occurred at the end of his, quote, opening argument, not his rebuttal. I haven't conceded anything vis-a-vis point two. I'm still at a loss based upon the record that this court must take, which is bedrock in this system of appellate review, where I've conceded anything. And while the state stands before this court today and says they haven't conceded error, that's fine. They haven't distinguished, cited, or discussed Perez, Chester, or Facundo. And it's easy to defend something. Excuse me, it's easy to make an argument, and it's harder still to defend it. If Rule 33.1 is designed to discourage sloppy lawyering, and if this court were to somehow find against the record in the case law that the veteran trial lawyer somehow, quote, failed to fulfill his duty, then obviously we've all set the stage for a post-conviction writ alleging ineffective assistance. The state asked this court why it was that veteran trial counsel never objected to those now famous four other arguments. It's because they weren't objectionable. They weren't objectionable. And so long as they weren't, LaJoy and its progeny give defense counsel every right to discuss the same verboten topic to defuse the original forensic misconduct. The state had filed its brief in this case, alluding initially to the now famous 10 convicts serving all of these monumental, draconian sentences from Hood County, and then withdrew that in the cover letter to the clerk, stating that the state had alluded to facts outside the record. And yet, inexplicably, they have premised their harm argument on the same unconscionable reference to facts outside the record, and that is just absolutely wrong. And I know this court will do what its own oath requires it to do, which is to wholly, wholly turn away from that notion that somehow this case turns on matters outside the record, or what Hood County juries and Harris County juries do not do. 60 is not right smack dab in the middle. How do we know that? The trial prosecutor told the jury that wasn't so. And at the end of the day, where the rubber meets the road in this case, Your Honors, is parole eligibility. And for purposes of parole eligibility, this court can take judicial notice, unlike the now famous 10 convicts from Hood County, that life and 60 years, or for that matter 99, are the same for purposes of parole. And again, this notion that in the event this court does what the law and the facts impel it to do, to sustain point one, that somehow the same result obtains 6 or 10 months down the road is, again, outside the record. It's not fair, it's right, and it's not just. The state asked this court, quote, not to short-circuit error preservation. I ask this court not to short-circuit Mr. Waters' right to a tolerably fair punishment hearing. I ask this court to sustain point one, to do what the record before this court and the case law the state has yet to discuss or distinguish compels, one tolerably fair punishment hearing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. You both came from a distance. The case is submitted. I do have one question before we adjourn. Is there any significance to the two purple ties in the courtroom?
Your Honor, my late mom's favorite color. I know that's outside the record, but I just had to say it.
I went to TCU.
There you go.
All right.